Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
I'm Roland Martin, host and managing editor of TV One's News One Now. Welcome to this special from the campus of Claflin University in Orangeburg, South Carolina, where we are here for a town hall with Democratic presidential candidate, Secretary Hillary Clinton. This is all about being able to ask her the critical questions that you care about, issues that affect you and your family. And so we certainly want to appreciate the Black Caucus of South Carolina for putting on this particular event. Let's go into the Minister's Hall for the town hall with Secretary Clinton. Let me introduce for you right now, folks, Democratic presidential candidate, Secretary Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
We did not coordinate our outfits, just letting y'all know.
Yeah, I told him he looked pretty sharp.
Let's jump right into it. Yesterday, jobs report came out for October. Unemployment rate drops to 5.0%, but for African Americans, it's 9.2%. Is there a need for a New Deal 2.0 and a Marshall Plan that targets those most in need, as opposed to folks will say you can't do anything race-based, but if you make it need-based, it will impact African-Americans and Latinos more than anybody else. What is your jobs plan specifically for those who don't have the opportunities as others?
Well, first of all, I am really relieved and pleased that overall we're making progress. And I have gone across this country making the point that when President Obama came into office, he inherited the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And he doesn't get the credit he deserves for digging us out of that big hole that he was handed when he came in. So it's been a long, slow effort, which thanks to him and his leadership and many, many millions of Americans, we are exactly where Roland said we are, down to 5% unemployment, jobs are coming back, but incomes are not rising. And so we have two big problems. One, we got to get incomes for everybody to go back up. And number two, we got to get more good jobs. And we do need, in my opinion, a targeted effort at people and communities that have not had the benefits of the recovery thus far. And we need to go even further. So very quickly, we need, once and for all, to have a very big infrastructure program on our roads, our bridges, tunnels, airports, rail systems, where we can put millions of people to work. Number two, we need to combat climate change by becoming the clean energy superpower of the 21st century. That means putting up wind turbines and installing solar panels and doing energy efficiency work and all the work that will enable us not only to have the economy grow, but move away from fossil fuels. Number three, we need to start investing in small business. And my particular hope is that I can be the small business president, and I want to focus on women and minority-owned small businesses in our country again. So all of those things, I think, will make a difference.
I'm going to come back to the small business question, but I want to deal with what you said about infrastructure. When you talked about creating those jobs, but historically, those labor unions have frozen us out. African Americans have not been able to get those construction jobs. They have not been able to be with those engineers. And so what will you say to those trade unions? Stop freezing out Black folks and other minorities from those opportunities.
Well, I think we have two problems that unfortunately have the same result. Where people are frozen out, or equally importantly, not sought out. I want to make sure every training program is reflective of our population. I want to provide an apprenticeship credit to companies, to unions, to others, to train young people particularly, but not just young anymore, Roland. We've got a lot of folks who've lost their jobs who are early middle-aged, and even older, and they need to be given some special attention. But we also have a problem. You know, labor unions are not the problem in much of the South, because they're all right-to-work states. And so we've got to make sure that anywhere we do infrastructure, if the federal government has any money into it, there must be a program for recruiting and hiring, and where necessary, training people from less advantaged communities. And that's going to be my goal.
We talked about the issue of small businesses. And the Wall Street Journal had a report March 14, 2014, where $23.09 billion in small business loans handed out in 2013. African Americans got 1.7% or $382 million. But in the last year of President Bush, 2008, it was 8.2% for African Americans. Housing crisis has a lot to do with that. The SBA administrator, she and I have met several times. They are trying to improve that. But that's a perfect example. You got 1.9 million black-owned businesses. They can't get access to capital. How will you utilize the federal government, utilize the SBA to ensure that expands as opposed to, again, getting 1.7% of $23 billion?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, when I was a senator from New York, this was one of the big issues that I had, because the federal government has a lot of contracts. But sometimes it's difficult for small businesses to know how to apply for those contracts. The procurement rules are really difficult. So I used to run procurement outreach programs and a big conference where we sought out small businesses, and again, with a special emphasis on minority and women-owned businesses. I think we've got to do that all the time. It can't be just a one-off deal. You've got to have a much more vigorous effort to reach out and help people, number one, apply for the contracts that are available. There is, and I agree with this, there is a preference in the law for small businesses that are minority and women-owned. I want to make sure that preference it is translated into benefits and doesn't just sit on the books and it doesn't have any results.
But also have bureaucrats who actually make the job
100%.
Happen.
100%. Well, you know, look, in my administration, what I want to do is to set some goals and tell people who work for me, this is what I want you to do. And if we really measure what we're doing, we can get results and we can change outcomes, I believe.
2010, I had a meeting at the Treasury Department with two officials who said that black and Hispanic firms outperformed everyone else on the management of TARP funds. My follow-up question was, did they get more money? Then the answer was no. What you have here, you have a good old boy system, largely whites in the Treasury Department. That's the only department that shares a lawn with the White House. Is that a perfect example of, if you're president, you will tell your Treasury Secretary you are to do what Maynard Jackson did, put economic power with political power, what David Paterson did as governor of New York, and say, no, you are going to expand those opportunities. If they're outperforming everybody else, they should get more business.
Well, if somebody tells you that a group or a person is outperforming everybody else, your question is the right question. Well, then are you going to reward that person or that group or business for having done that? My answer is yes. And I want, you know, you mentioned a couple of examples. You see, I think that when you look at the economy, there are opportunities that we are not seizing on behalf of communities and individuals. And I don't think there's any doubt at all that we've got to do more to open doors and to rebuild those ladders of opportunity. So when it comes to businesses, particularly, as I say, you know, small business, minority and women owned, I'm going to be vigilant and I'm going to drive people to get results. And what I like about what you said is, you know, we're not doing this as charity, we're doing it as business. We want good business people to have more opportunities. And when they do well, we need to reward that, and that's what I intend to do.
Last 7 years, 53% of black wealth was wiped out.
You talk so fast. Am I talking too fast in response? I mean,
no.
Raise your hand if you think we're both talking too fast, but he's got a lot to ask. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, plus they're saying rap. No, I got some other stuff to ask.
Yeah, I got it. I know.
53% of black wealth was wiped out in the home foreclosure crisis. Elizabeth Warren said when she was on the Congressional Committee, it will take two generations for African Americans just to recoup that money. One of the things the federal government did not do, and if I will say this here, one of the greatest failures of the Obama administration has been their housing policies. HAMP was supposed to help 4 million people, it only helped 900,000. Will you, if you're president, force the Federal Housing Finance Agency to write down the principle of underwater homeowners? And will you push Congress to modify the bankruptcy code to push for cram downs in bankruptcy so that the people who have homes can maintain those homes and we not simply bail out banks and not bail out homeowners?
Well, I advocated that back in 07 and 08, Roland. In fact, I was very unhappy that we did not do enough to help people who were in their homes save their homes. So I will look for ways to try to, number one, stop the damage so that we don't lose more homes because people still haven't recovered. But number two, we've got to get back into the home ownership business. And a lot of financial institutions are reluctant to loan. And they're more reluctant to loan to African-American and Latino
purchasers. But they're sitting on housing stock that earlier were distressed assets, and now they're simply selling those off to hedge owners.
And I don't agree with that. I think that's wrong. And we're now starting to see some of the bad behavior coming from the folks who bought those homes. You know, they're forcing people out. Big article today about misleading people and forcing them to turn over their home under false pretenses. So you're right. You know, what happened in 07, 08 is just beyond horrible. You know, 9 million people lost their jobs, 5 million lost their homes, and $13 trillion in family wealth was wiped out, most of it in home ownership, but also IRAs, 401ks, college funds. Everybody had to take the money out in order to live. So we have a lot of catching up to do, and it's not enough if just some people recover. I want to do what I can to help everybody recover.
The topic that stood out to me the most was how much work she wants to do with women and minority small business owners. I think they get overlooked a lot, and it's really powerful to see how much she cares about those small business owners.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
In 1991, I graduated from college, and I interviewed at the Birmingham News. All 16 editors there wanted to hire me, but the HR department said no because of my credit report. The increasing number of people across this country who are being denied jobs because of credit reports and credit scores. Do you support Congresswoman Maxine Waters' bill that deals with the issue of repairing the Fair Credit Act? And in most cases, wiping out requirements to have folks go through credit checks when they're applying for jobs, federal contractors as well as federal agencies.
You know, that I generally agree with that. I don't know the specific of Maxine's legislation, but I will obviously look at it immediately. But I want to make two general points. One, sometimes credit reports are wrong. But let's deal with that problem because...
And her act deals with that.
Yes, and that is a serious problem for a lot of people. Secondly, look, I think a lot of credit problems, particularly for young people, have to do with student debt, have to do with credit cards that they had to use in order to stay in college, in order to be able to get their education. There are a lot of reasons why I don't think you should have credit reports following you around like some anchor that you have to carry with you. So yeah, I want people to be responsible. I want them to pay their debts, but I also want to make sure you got a second chance. And it shouldn't be that you are denied a job that has nothing to do, as I understand working for the Birmingham newspaper would have, with your credit score or your credit situation. So we need to take a hard look at that, and I'll look at Maxine's bill.
Last Friday, you were in Atlanta. There were people who were there who interrupted your speech, and some folks chanted Black Lives Matter. Do you fully understand the reticence of some folks when they say, under your husband, who's president, he signed into law the crime bill that has contributed to the mass incarceration problem. He signed the welfare bill that many say is onerous as well. Do you understand their sentiment? And one of the other questions is, why not roll out your entire criminal justice program at one time as opposed to individual speeches?
Well, first of all, I do understand the sense of frustration and, you know, disappointment and even outrage that young people like those that were in Atlanta last week feel, because there's a lot of things that need to be fixed. And they're impatient, and they deserve to be impatient, and they deserve to hear answers from people like me running for office, particularly president. My only, and I've met with them. I've had some very good open, productive conversations with representatives of the Black Lives Matter movement. I wish they had listened, because a lot of what we have talked about together are part of the proposals that I'm making. And the reason we roll them out, and this is an interesting point to make to you as a leading member of the press, is you get more attention paid to them. If you put it out one day, it's a one-day story. If you roll them out, you get covered as you roll them out. So we've been rolling out, starting with the very first speech that I gave in this campaign back in, I don't know, March or April, about criminal justice reform, incarceration reform, and we're going to keep doing that because I want people to look at what I am proposing. We're going to reduce minimum mandatory sentences. We're going to finally remove the difference between powder and crack cocaine, which has been in a terrible, unfair burden. We are going to ban the box and let people apply for jobs, and only at the end, if they get to that end, they get to be they talk about whatever record they might have. We're going to invest much more in treatment and recovery and support and jobs and training programs. So we have a very robust agenda, and I feel, you know, very committed to this. And I particularly want young people who share the impatience and the disappointment. And, you know, I think we should be talking about going forward, but I will say, back in the 90s, that bill was in response to a horrific decade of crime, and leaders of the communities of color and poor communities were in the forefront saying, you must do something. And it was done, and it did have a lot of positive but also negative unintended consequences. That's why we have to take another look. That's what a democracy should do. Look at the evidence and make changes based on it.
You mentioned mandatory minimums. Why not get rid of all of them and allow judges to have the discretion, as opposed to still having mandatory minimums where you got some folks who are in jail for 20, 30 years for small offenses?
Well, we want to get rid of the nonviolent, low-level offenses being a way to go into jail or prison. We think there's a lot more diversionary work that can be done about that. But, you know, Roland, this is like everything else. It cuts both ways. If you reduce the mandatory minimums, I believe then we can see, does it reduce discrimination? And discrimination can be on both sides, because what happens right now, which you know so well, is that African American men are far more likely to be arrested, to be charged, to be convicted, to be incarcerated for doing the same things as white men. So we want to reduce those minimums, but we also don't want to open the door to a different form of discrimination. So we're looking hard at how this would actually be applied in the real world.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
So much for being here this afternoon. What's the plan of accountability for companies for disparities in pay between men and women? And then how can we as women ensure that we are receiving equal pay for the same work?
Amen. Amen. I have to tell you, I do not do a town hall anywhere in America without being asked this question. And for all those Republicans who say this is not a real world problem, I wish they would come to my town halls, because I don't know who they're talking to, because it is. And I think there are several things we do. Number one, just talking about it, making sure people can't ignore it or diminish it or pretend that, you know, it's somebody else's problem. But then we have to enforce the laws that are already on the books, and I will do that vigilantly, because this is not just a woman's issue. This is a family issue, and this is an economic issue. And the other thing is, one of the things that, and you got right to it, one of the things that stands in the way of knowing how widespread this is the fact that in many businesses, you can be fired for asking somebody else in the business how much they're paid. So a lot of women don't know they are being paid less than the men that they're working beside doing the same job. That's what happened to Lily Ledbetter, the woman in Alabama who had worked in a big factory for years. She got promoted okay. She became the first, you know, woman foreman, I guess, or woman forewoman. And she worked there, and it was only by accident she learned that although there were four or five men doing the very same job, she was being paid less. So I want to remove any doubt that transparency is acceptable, and if there needs to be changes in the rules or the laws about businesses so that they cannot retaliate, so that you can find out how much you're being paid, so you can compare your pay to other workers in the same situation. I'll tell you just a real quick story. A young man came up to me in New Hampshire. He said to me, I want to tell you why I'm for you. And he was like in his mid to late 20s. He said his first real job was working as a cashier in the same store that his mother worked in, part of a chain. And he was 17, and he was so proud because this was like the first job, and he got it because his mother introduced him to somebody. It was, you know, great. So he comes home with his first paycheck. His mother looks at it, and her face falls, and she tells him, you're making a dollar more an hour than I am, and I've been there 4 years. So he went to find out, and the manager said, well, yeah, you're a young man. We think you've got a lot of potential to go up in the business, and well, what about my mother? So we're going to tackle this, and we're going to end it once and for all.
All right. I have another question here.
Madam President.
From your lips to God's ears, right?
We've got a problem here, not only in South Carolina, but in most of the southern states and throughout the United States, with guns. What will you do to get rid of all these guns that are on the streets, that are in the homes, that are inadvertently killing youngsters in their homes? What will you do to help us out with that?
Well, this is an issue that I just think we have got to address. I understand how politically challenging it is. 90 people a day die in our country from guns. Homicide, suicide, and avoidable accidents like what the gentleman was referring to. And it is imperative that people make this a voting issue. I know we can balance the legitimate rights of gun owners with the right to be safe going to school or going to church, the right to have more control over what happens in people going to stores to buy guns who shouldn't have them. So here's what I am proposing. Number one, we need universal background checks for real. We need to close the gun show loophole. We need to close the online loophole because people are buying guns and ammunition online. You have no idea who they are. And we know some of the mass murderers, that's how they got what they used to kill people. We need to close what's called the Charleston loophole. The Charleston loophole is, unfortunately, what enabled that young man to get a gun he was not entitled to. He was a felon. He had a felony conviction. But under the rules, 3 business days is all you get to find out. And the information hadn't been shared between 2 jurisdictions. So after 3 days, he went, he got that gun, and he went to Mother Emanuel, and he murdered those 9 wonderful people. And then we need to remove the immunity that gun makers and sellers have. They're the only industry in America that we give blanket immunity to. You can do anything. And then that gets to the final point I want to make about what you asked. Gun makers should be required to apply technology that currently exists so that guns owned by responsible adults cannot be operated by children, or if they are stolen, cannot be used by criminals. And what I am just appalled at are the numbers of young children, I'm talking toddlers, who go into a closet or go under a bed or open a drawer and there's a loaded gun. And these children kill themselves, they kill their playmates, they kill their siblings, they kill their parents, they injure people. That is crazy, my friends. So I know that the NRA and the gun lobby are powerful, but I think the American people are more powerful, and the right to life is the most powerful of all.
Secretary, we are the campus of a historically black college. We have another one just next door. What is your HBCU plan to deal with HBCUs, because when we talk about black doctors and black lawyers and black engineers, they are being graduated from HBCUs. And will you reverse the Obama administration's Parent PLUS loan change that led to 15,000 students not coming back to HBCU campuses, millions of dollars of loss? Will you reverse that policy? And what is your plan to assist historically black colleges and universities?
I have what's called, Roland, my new college compact, and it does two things, and it would affect both State and Claflin in this way. If you are going to a public college or university, you will not have to borrow money to pay for tuition, and you will be able to use your Pell Grant if you get one for living expenses. And so we are going to make it possible for far more young people to be able to go to college, finish college, and graduate without that debt. With respect to HBCUs, that will help the public HBCUs because they will certainly be included. But I want to go further than that, and I have a special provision of a pot of $25 billion for HBCUs, including private institutions, because I agree completely with what Roland said. These are the places that graduate black professionals, and we need more, not fewer, and I will reverse the impact of the loan changes.
So again, you say you will reverse that?
Yes, because I think that, well, first of all, my plan will mean that it's not necessary. But for those young people who dropped out, we need to figure out how to get them back in. So we have to reverse the effects that led them to have to drop out.
I believe that Mrs. Clinton needs to be present in the African-American community, be attentive. In order to secure the vote, she has to certainly make promises and keep them and be present in the moments.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Good afternoon, Secretary Clinton, and thank you so much for coming here to South Carolina. Do you think your husband was right in signing NAFTA into law? And the second part of my question is, what will your administration do to bring back industrial-based jobs to South Carolina?
Well, you know, I know how controversial trade has been in South Carolina, and South Carolina is a classic case of winners and losers because of trade. And the biggest losers have been the textile firms, because a lot of those jobs, not just through NAFTA, but through differences in costs of production, went to Asia as well. So I don't think we can blame the loss of the textile industry on NAFTA. I think it was broader than that. NAFTA may have opened the door more widely for jobs to go to Mexico, but textile jobs were under global pressure even without NAFTA. Now, what does that mean? Because the other side of the equation is that South Carolina has attracted a great number of car companies, more advanced manufacturing companies. So it's a kind of good news, bad news story. What I want to do is to make it possible for us to recruit both internally within the United States and externally from abroad more jobs, and I'm not sure, I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure we can get textile jobs back unless they are more sophisticated, requiring higher levels of expertise in the dyeing and the printing and whatever else is required. But I do think we can get more advanced manufacturing jobs back if we provide more tax credit and more tax support. If we do what I said at the very beginning, we have more apprenticeship programs, so we're training our workforce right here at home. And that's where education comes in, because we have still too many people who don't have the skills that are required to do the advanced manufacturing. So I want a nationwide effort, but to focus on poorer states with larger poor populations like South Carolina, to do more in a kind of, as you were saying, a new deal or a new training program, so that we actually take seriously the idea we can get and keep these jobs. And it's one of the reasons why I came out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership bill, because we have to trade. Look, we are 5% of the world's population. We have to build things and sell things to the other 95%. So people who are against trade under any circumstances, no matter what, I think are kind of missing the point. We need smart trade and fair trade and effective trade, and we need to mix it with taking care of our own people. So if you open the door to trade, which I'm all for, you got to make sure you've got people in your own country who are able to compete for those jobs. And the Republicans are all for trade, but they're not for job training. They're not for preschool education that'll prepare kids. They're not for reskilling the workforce. They don't want to spend any money on that. And I am holding out to say, okay, we can do trade, but we can only do trade that is going to benefit the American people across the board if we invest in our own people and we give them the skills and opportunities to be successful.
Question.
If you would address the voter ID bill here and voter suppression and how our lines are drawn, I think a lot would help the situation with one comment that was brought up at the forum last night, and that is automatic registration of all 18-year-olds. Automatically, when you turn 18, you would be a registered voter. Could you please comment and what your response, or how would you go about doing that, or if you agree?
Well, actually, I proposed that. I was the first person to propose that in a speech that I gave about voting rights at Texas Southern University, where I received the Barbara Jordan Award a couple months ago, last summer, I think. And the reason I proposed it is because I believe strongly that young people should be registered when they turn 18. Now, for legal reasons, they can opt out of that, but I don't think the vast majority would, and I want to see young people registered at 18. But you raise a much bigger point. You know, when the Supreme Court, and these are my words, gutted the Voting Rights Act by rejecting the Congress reauthorizing it, and I was in the Senate then, we voted 98-0 to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court was basically sending a message to political leaders that they could begin to try to find new ways to interfere with the right to vote. Now, that may not have been their intention, but that has been the result. And so all these photo ID, you know, we did not have a problem of any magnitude whatsoever. Our problem is not people illegally trying to vote. Our problem is that legal folks are not doing what they should to vote to make sure their voices are heard. And so I have been taking on this issue, and I'm going to keep taking it on. And I think the Supreme Court was absolutely wrong. There's legislation now being promoted in the Congress to try to repair the damage that the Supreme Court did. But in the meantime, we need to have political action, we need to have litigation, we need to have mobilization against these efforts to suppress the vote. Now you ask yourself, why are they doing that? Well, it's pretty simple. There's some people, they don't want to vote.
Secretary, at TV One, we conducted a poll of black parents, and we asked them the question about charters and school vouchers. 74% of black parents said they were interested in enrolling their kids in charter schools. 79% favored school vouchers. We are in the state where really Brown versus Board of Education got its start. 61 years, black folks are still waiting for education to get right. Do you support the expansion of charter schools and school vouchers when black parents overwhelmingly say they want the best for their kids and they are not satisfied with what's happening in traditional public schools?
Well, I have for many years now, about 30 years, supported the idea of charter schools, but not as a substitute for the public schools, but as a supplement for the public schools. And what I have worked on through my work with the Children's Defense Fund and my work on education in Arkansas and through my time as First Lady and Senator is to continue to say charter schools can have a purpose, but you know, there are good charter schools and there are bad charter schools, just like there are good public schools and
right,
there are bad public schools.
So let's get rid of all bad and accept.
But I am still a firm believer that the public school system is one of the real pillars of our democracy, and it is a path for opportunity. But I am also fully aware that there are a lot of substandard public schools. But part of the reason for that is that policymakers and local politicians will not fund schools in poor areas that take care of poor children to the level that they need to be. And you could get me going on this because it's not, I mean, the corridor of shame right here in South Carolina, you get on there and you can see schools that are literally falling apart. I've been in some of those schools. I have seen the terrible physical conditions. That is an outrage. It is a rebuke to who we are as Americans to send any child to a school that you wouldn't send your own child to. And so we got a lot of work to do to make sure that public schools serve people, but that doesn't mean we don't also provide options within the system so that parents can find what they think might work best for their kids.
As far as one thing that I took away from what she said, which I love the most, is South Carolina public school system, they're not taken care of very well. And because of the SC state is because the policymakers are not funding the schools the way they're supposed to be. Coming from Prince George's County, where we are middle class, and coming to Orangeburg, where there's so many schools that have infrastructure problems, and they're just not well equipped for students. And I love the fact that she says when she gets in office, she's going to make sure that that happens, and she's going to make sure that federal monies get to places where they need to get.
Tuesday nights are about to get real, cause Ricky Smiley's back in a brand new series. Check out his real friends, his real kids, and his real crazy life.
Did y'all see that?
Ricky Smiley, for real, tomorrow at 8 on TV One.
Introducing Kisses Deluxe Chocolates. With a whole roasted hazelnut, delicate crisps, and layers of rich, creamy chocolate, they're twice the size of the Kisses chocolates you love. Say more with new Kisses Deluxe.
This test paper represents proteins in your skin. Watch it react to direct contact with ordinary soap. Soap weakens the proteins. Dove is different. With 1/4 moisturizing cream and mild cleansers, Dove helps skin maintain its natural moisture.
Felicia was being exposed to Marcus's pimp business.
He sold her a dream, so she did everything she could to please him.
If she's killed somebody, he's got her for life.
An all-new episode of For My Man, tonight at 10 on TV One.
Madam Secretary, in 1989, we passed the Fire Real legislation by Congress to allow them to bail out the savings and loan. The president bailed out the banks. But in the 1989 Fire Real legislation, we said that those banks had to create community reinvestment under the Community Reinvestment Act, which is expansion of that legislation. What will you do to get these banks back moving to invest back in our communities?
Great question. You know, I believe in the community reinvestment program, and again, it's something that Democrats have had to defend against Republican attacks for decades now. And there are good examples of it working, but increasingly in later years, it has not. And there are two approaches. One, the Treasury Department and the bank regulators need to ensure that banks are meeting their obligations under community reinvestment. And there are a lot of good programs that we can point to. If they don't know what to do, we can show them what to do and what will work to create economic opportunity. And secondly, you mentioned Shore Bank, which I worked with. And then in Arkansas, I helped to start the Arkansas Development Corporation, because I think that in addition to getting conventional banks to do what they can, we need some more of these development banks, like South Shore was the example, and what we did in Arkansas has had a real positive effects. Now, the final thing I'll say about this is, you know, there's a big fight going on in Washington about the Dodd-Frank bill and the rules that it placed on the banking community, primarily aimed at the biggest banks that were contributors to some of the problems that we had, like the mortgage and other problems that we were talking about earlier. A lot of community banks say, hey, those rules fell on us too. We're just a small community bank or a small regional bank. So I want to, without giving any relief to the big banks, because I do think they need to be regulated so they don't get us in trouble again, I want to provide, you know, some opportunities for community banks to be able to once more be partners in community reinvestment. So those are my approaches.
With more states legalizing marijuana for both medical and recreational use, what is your plan to tackle the issue of marijuana prohibition on the federal level?
Well, here's what I believe. I believe that states are taking this step, and You know, there's that great phrase attributed, I think, to Roosevelt, that states are the laboratories of democracy. And I want to see how it works before we do a national plan from the federal government, because I think there's a lot for us to learn. But what I do want is for us to support research into medical marijuana, because a lot more states have passed medical marijuana than have legalized marijuana. So we've got two different experiences or even experiments going on right now. And the problem with medical marijuana is that there's a lot of anecdotal evidence about how well it works for certain conditions, but we haven't done any research. Why? Because it's considered what's called a Schedule I drug, and you can't even do research in it. So I would like to move it from what's called Schedule I to Schedule II, so that, you know, researchers at universities, at the National Institute of Health, could start researching what's the best way to use it. How much dose does somebody need? How does it interact with other medications? Because if we're going to have a lot of states setting up marijuana dispensaries so that people who have some kind of medical need are getting marijuana, we need to know what's the quality of it, how much should you take, what should you avoid if you're taking other medications. So that's how I'm currently thinking about it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Martin and Secretary Clinton. When I had the pleasure of meeting you a few minutes ago, you mentioned you were a Girl Scout. So what character traits did you learn while scouting that you would use to be a successful president?
That is such a great question. Let's give this young man a round of applause. Oh my gosh. I did. I told him that I was a scout. I started as a brownie. I was a Girl Scout through high school, and I learned a lot. In addition to the little merit badge things you learn, which he's got some of his merit badges on his uniform, I learned about teamwork. I learned about cooperating with other people. I learned how important it is that when you say you're going to do something, you do everything you can to keep your word and do it. I learned about how scouting has, for so many decades now, helped young women and young men learn things that they might not have otherwise learned. So I learned specific things as well as general values and character traits that I think are really important for everybody to learn, but which scouting has made a big difference in.
Since he has the uniform on, if you are a veteran or in the military, please stand up. Secretary, stay standing. Secretary, a few weeks ago, you were doing an interview and you talked about the VA scandal not being as widespread as it was reported. Veterans Day is Wednesday, November 11th. Right. Typically, when a president appoints Secretary of Veteran Affairs, it's sort of one of the last appointments not considered major. I believe that if we care for our troops, that we will make that just as important as the AG, as the Defense Secretary, as Secretary of State. What is your commitment to ensuring that the Department of Veterans Affairs is the best federal agency, and will you make that a fundamental priority if you're President of the United States?
And the answer is yes. And you know, what I said a few weeks ago was that there are certainly systemic problems with the VA, and they need to be fixed, and nobody should tolerate them. It's an outrage if anybody has been either mistreated or left untreated by the VA. But I also believe the VA has done good things, and the Republicans are always trying to privatize everything, privatize education, privatize Social Security, privatize Medicare, and yes, privatize the VA. So I'm going to fix it, and I will appoint somebody with proven management experience who will weed out those who should not be there in the first place, end programs that are not working, take what is good about the VA, and make sure it is available to all of our veterans. That is my goal.
I have always said that broke is broke, whether you broke white or broke black. And yet it's interesting when we have a discussion in America about poverty, it's always a black face. Mm. If you are president, how will you lead or drive a conversation to get white America who is broke to understand that your education, your health, your lack of economic access is the same as African Americans and others, and how do you see having that discussion? Because rural communities have the same fundamental problems as inner city communities, but they somehow think that they're totally different.
That's a fair point, because poverty is debilitating no matter where it happens or who it affects. And there is such a lack of understanding in our country about the number of poor white folks. And we just had a study come out that said poor white middle-aged Americans without a high school education are dying at a higher rate than they have ever died before. Addiction, alcoholism, suicide. So poverty is poverty. You know, there's a great idea that Congressman Jim Clyburn has put forward called 10-20-30.
Yep.
That 10% of federal funds would go to communities where 20% of the people are living in poverty and have done so for more than 30 years.
Two-thirds of those counties are Republican counties.
And white. Predominantly white. So as Jim Clyburn pointed out to me when he was describing this to me, this would be a recipe for dealing with poverty everywhere based on the numbers. If you're living in an impoverished generational situation, then you need help, and the government should not be turning its back on you. And I'm in favor of empowerment. One of the programs that my husband put into place, the New Markets Tax Credit, was used to help build up poor rural communities, to provide more economic opportunity. And it's been allowed to lapse by the Republican Congress. There are tools at our disposal. But the point that you make is an especially important one. We need to be talking about this so that the caricatures and the stereotypes that too often, you know, flood the media are, you know, once and for all retired.
So poor is poor. So would you, as running for president, do what Bobby Kennedy did and literally go to those communities? What he did going to the Delta gave a whole different view, and literally all the cameras that follow you, bring them with you to those areas and say, America, these are broke white people who are poor, and this is what poverty looks like, not some black single mother in Chicago or Detroit.
Well, and he went to Appalachia as well. It was Delta. It was the Delta in Appalachia. Well, let me just point out that, you know, a lot of Republican governors are not expanding Medicaid, including right here in South Carolina. I mean, you talk about this recent study that I mentioned where you have middle-aged white folks killing themselves, getting addicted to drugs and alcohol, not getting help for mental illness or substance abuse. That's a health problem. And people are oftentimes in rural areas especially not as reachable through health systems. So I think we've got to look at this from the perspective of what do we do to make our country healthier? And the people most in need of that are poor people, wherever they live and whoever they are. So I feel passionately about this. As I said, when, you know, my first job out of law school was with the Children's Defense Fund, started by Marion Wright Edelman from Bennettsville, South Carolina. And so I've spent my first job for the Children's Defense Fund was coming to South Carolina to do an investigation about juveniles in adult jails. Sound familiar? So, I mean, we make progress, but then we kind of fall back. You cannot grow weary doing the work.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Last question for me. Black women, stand up. Black women. Secretary Clinton, if you become president of the United States and you got to appoint somebody to the Supreme Court, will you put a black woman on the Supreme Court?
Do we have some candidates here? Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll certainly consider I'll certainly consider people who have the energy and the intellect and the experience to be on the Supreme Court, and probably on the younger side, because I want them to be there a long time.
Well, we got a whole list. So it's good to see, it would be good to see a sister on the Supreme Court.
I want to end by saying this. A president can do a lot and should. And I will work as hard as I know how to find common ground, even with people that I don't agree with politically. Because if we can find common ground on something important, we should go forward together. But I also want to be a partner to those making change in state legislatures, in communities across a state like this. Because a president can also do things that are not in the formal job description, so that I can convene groups. We want to know what's the best way to improve job training for advanced manufacturing. We're going to get people who are doing it, know how to do it together, and we're going to come up with a plan, and we're going to try to sell everybody about doing that. So convening, catalyzing change, connecting people up, like the Arkansas Development Bank Corporation, which I helped to start. Let's find out why it succeeded and why South Shore didn't, and how we can do more of what works in communities like those here in South Carolina. And I want to be a coordinator and connector so that we get people to really understand what we are capable of doing no matter where we are. Don't wait for somebody in Washington. Make the, you know, make the political demands, like what you need from Washington. And try to hold your elected officials accountable. And if we could get voter registration up in South Carolina, your elected officials would look different than they look right now in many parts of the state. And so, you know, we've got to work in a partnership from the grassroots up and from the top down, and we got to give more people the tools to make the best decisions for their own lives. That's what I grew up doing, that's what I learned to do, and that's what I will do as your president.
Secretary Clinton, it's a pleasure. Thank you so very much. Claflin, thanks you as well. Round of applause, please, Democratic presidential candidate.
Thank you, Rowan.
Secretary Hillary Clinton. We certainly hope you enjoyed this TV One News One Now special from the campus of Claflin University here in Orangeburg, South Carolina. And we certainly hope that you were able to learn more about Secretary Hillary Clinton, her views on issues that you care about the most. The vote is an important one, and is important for all the candidates, Democrat and Republican, to speak to the issues that you care about and what matters to you and your family. For everyone here at TV One, I'm Roland Martin. Have a great day.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.